Hello, Mr. Chavez. This is Lud Ahrens. I work with audio tape. Magnetape's purpose is to effectively broadcast the most vital information that receptive people need to create a more rational society. This is an old program, but I think you'll enjoy it despite the fidelity. Your tapes live after you're gone. Nice meeting you.
Saul Alinsky is, by his own definition, a professional radical. He organizes people so that they can speak for themselves and so that they can see that their own interests are represented. He also trains other people so that they can do this. And all of these things he does as head of the Industrial Areas Foundation, which has its headquarters in Chicago. In college, Mr. Alinsky majored in archaeology. After 2 years of graduate work, he went into criminology and then into union organizing. In 1939, he went into the activity he has been in ever since, which is community organizing. Mr. Alinsky, it seems to me that organizing must appear to those in it, or most people who are in it, as unattractive work, because it must seem to the organizer that people simply refuse to believe the truth, simply refuse to help themselves. Is that how the world seems to an organizer?
No.
No?
No, if he felt that way about people, if he felt that they were apathetic, that they just gave up and so on, and that there wasn't any hope, and that the future couldn't be worked out, he wouldn't be organizing. You know, he'd cop out. You know, this is the way people are, and what the hell, if that's the way, if they're willing to buy it that way, well, why should I worry about it? He'd become a cynic, which so many people really are in their own ways, copping out. Now, let me put it to you this way. It's really tremendously exciting, because if there's one thing that man is always trying to do, is to create. Now, if you want to say he's trying to play God that way, you know, like the great creator, he's trying to see whether he can change things, or he's trying to figure out what it's all about. He's trying to make his life have some meaning. Now, to be able to take a look at, say, a scene like Back of the Yards in Chicago, what was Upton Sinclair's Jungle. That was the scene, site of the Sinclair's Jungle. 250,000 people living in absolute demoralization, poverty, just plain crap. And I look at the meat packers who were then in Chicago, the big establishment, you know, hog butcher of the world at that time, Sandberg's line and all that. And I'd be able to say, well, we're going to organize all these people. We're going to get all this power. We're going to turn it all around. We're going to change it all around and make a whole new life and be able to do it. That's not dull.
Organizers don't feel that what they're carrying, in effect, is the revealed truth and the people just won't accept it. It's not like being an unsuccessful traveling salesman.
No, some do, but they're not the organizer who feels that he has the truth, that he has the ideology, the gospel, and he carries within him not a love for people. He carries really a hate, because within him is a certain elitism that, you know, I know what's good for you, and damn you, this is what you're going to have whether you like it or not. Now, on the other hand, however, Ed, you do have to have a certain ego as an organizer. Now, it's not, don't confuse it with egotism, with being arrogant and all the rest of those things. But it's a kind of ego where you can look at a city and say, I'm going to organize it. Nothing's going to stop me. Otherwise, you know, you'd just have diarrhea and run for cover. Now, organizers and educators, for example, are the same. Because what an organizer is doing is he's really educating people. He's saying, look, let's get together. Let's figure this out. Now, you want some changes? Well, you can't have change without power. You know that. Now, let's see how we can get power. And so he starts doing it. Now, he's an agitator. When the establishment calls us outside agitators, they're absolutely right. That's what an educator is. An educator who really educates, agitates your mind. Socrates, for example. The Greeks knew what they were doing when they killed him. Socrates was educating them to ask questions. Not to accept the answers of the system around them. The moment they started questioning the nature of truth, you cannot fence in the human mind. Once you turn it on so it starts questioning, it starts moving in all directions. And, that's a good example of this ego that I mentioned before, because if you may remember, in Socrates' Apologia, He's looking at the Greeks, and he's saying to them, now look, one other thing. He's pleading for his life at this point. One other thing, if you kill me, where else are you going to find another one like me? After all, you need me. I am, and that's where the famous line comes from. I am the gadfly the steed of the state. And you better be careful not to kill me, you know.
Let me ask you about something you just said, which is that when you open the human mind, then there are no limits. Let's apply that to organizing technique for a moment. You decided a couple of years ago that you wanted to do some organizing on the basis of an attack on pollution. Now, did you do that with the intention of dealing only with pollution, or did you believe that by getting people interested in pollution and organizing to deal with that, they could be led on to dealing with other things?
Oh, sure, the latter, completely. The problem of pollution, if you ask me on a personal basis, pollution in the Pentagon and in the White House. You know, not just the air and the and water and so on. But you start with one issue, and an issue which is specific and immediate as far as people are concerned. When you say to them, well, here's this pollution that you're suffering from this utility or this problem right here and now. Because unless it's something that is specific and immediate and you can do something about, you're not going to start getting organization going. And the same thing goes for the development of the proxy tactic or anything else. None of them within themselves are really more than simple devices to try to get people organized, because as they get organized and get power and start moving, then a whole series of other issues begins to unfold.
Well, what is happening on your proxy organization? You call it proxies for people.
No.
The idea is to have influence within corporations by gathering the proxies of shareholders for particular purposes.
Well, that...
That's inadequate.
That's inadequate. That seems to be the general feeling about it. That isn't why Kodak really broke on the proxies thing. You see, if you were to get all of the proxies of all of the stock that's outstanding, let's say a major corporation, General Motors, DuPont, corporation of that sort, you might be able to get about 8%, because a big bulk of stocks are held in financial conglomerates. They're held by other corporations. They're held in big mutual funds. They're not held by the public generally. And this is one of those myths that, America, when you go public, so-called, in a big corporation, the stock is then held by the public. The use of proxies hits in different ways. It's never just in the proxy power itself. This is one reason why I had serious questions and talked it over subsequently with my good friend Ralph Nader on his General Motors thing, because if General Motors had any political literacy whatsoever, they would simply have given them five directors, and so what? It wouldn't have made any difference within the operation of that corporation, so their meetings would have gone maybe an hour later, longer, and that's all. They still would have done everything they wanted to do. But it's when you get the kind of scene, for example, when I addressed the National Unitarian Convention during the Kodak fight and asked them for their stock proxies on their holdings of Kodak stock, and they voted to give them behind us. And right after that broke on the news wires, I had gone down to a bar with some people right after the speech and after my speech and after they had voted on it. I got back to my hotel room 2 hours later, and there was a pack of telegrams from Washington and from congressmen and senators, and everyone reading, what can I do to help you? Now, what happened was obvious. The moment the word was flashed on the wires, senators and congressmen turned to their research directors and said, how many Unitarians have I got in my district, you know? So the political pressure begins to build up. Now, it's in this way, on different levels, that proxies begin to exert power on corporations. Then you can turn around and look at some of them and say, okay, it's time that we started some Sherman antitrust proceedings against you, General Motors, against you, Eastman Kodak, against you, and so forth. That's when they start backing off. Then, of course, it cuts on other levels, too. Can you imagine a scene that I'm sure you had in mind when you asked that question, where you compel General Motors to hold their stockholders meeting not in a barroom of a mezzanine of the Waldorf or the Hilton, but out in Yankee Stadium, because you're bringing 75,000, 80,000 stockholders from all over the country to New York, or else you're having new sympathetic New Yorkers who are being given your endorsed stock proxies to go to the meeting. And SEC has been notified that you're coming, so that GM can't hold that meeting and say, well, you know, we got the Hilton or the Americana, but unfortunately, we can't accommodate all those people. We didn't know they were going. So then let's have that scene in Yankee Stadium. And somebody gets up and moves that General Motors not accept any further contracts from the Pentagon for this absurdity in Vietnam, say. And it's seconded. And then somebody moves for the boat, and you hear, and with all TV cameras and everything else on the thing, and you hear 75,000 or 80,000 people getting up and voting aye. And then this guy sitting up there, chairman of the board or whoever's running the meetings, says, well, having 90% of the stock proxies endorsed over to management here, I vote nay, and that's a Democratic decision. Well, what the hell's going to happen to the myth of public ownership of General Motors and that kind of a scene?
Well, what have you accomplished then through proxies for people? Where can you show progress?
Well, on proxies, when we developed the thing with Kodak, the consequence of it came the settlement with the recognition of the black organization that had been built.
This is in Rochester.
In Rochester, New York. As the spokesman, it meant all kinds of changes subsequently with representation in police, education. And it meant also the development of a major industry, which is a subcontractor for Xerox, with the Xerox Corporation. And this industry is owned, you talk about black capitalism or anything else of that sort, this industry is owned by the local black organization. And the job training program included everything from directors and president, officers, superintendents, executives, all the way down, instead of just the people on the machines. Now, this is important in another way, too, because basically, as we start looking over the black-white economy scene, when people start talking about, say, getting white slum landlords out or white businessmen out of the black communities and so forth, okay, so get them out. But what's going to happen in the black communities? You make a grocery store, black-owned, and you may have three or four jobs. Take over a gas station, you may have another half dozen jobs, but this is peddling stuff. The money in our economy is in our corporate economy. It's in the major corporations and subcontracting and so on. And this is what has happened in Rochester in their fight on organization, which is tied in with Xerox. That's one example of what you're
asking. Are there other examples?
Yeah, there are other examples in Chicago, for example, on the Woodlawn scene, which was also a black community. When they went in for redevelopment of the community as far as housing and as far as supermarts and gas stations and so on, it wasn't just a case of their bringing in supermarts and saying, well, now look, we want a non-discriminatory job, personnel policy. We want quality of merchandise similar to outside of the black ghetto. We want prices that are not any higher than outside of the ghetto and so forth, and letting it go there. They came in with a supermart with all these things, but they also being a full partner, a full, complete financial partner on everything, power, finances, and so on. They did the same thing with gas stations, they did the same thing with movie theaters, the same thing with the whole shopping complex, and the same thing with housing that they're doing there.
Mr. Alinsky, you have lately turned to organizing middle-class people, whereas before you organized mainly working-class people, blacks. Why the change?
Well, before, let me correct one thing, because we've been associated so much with blacks in the last 8-9 years. Before that, Mexican-Americans, because then we were organizing all the Mexican-Americans in California. Those were the days when we were hiring and training people like Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, Fred Ross, all these people that you read about out there today. Matter of fact, we've got quite an illustrious alumni group.
Yes, I know you have. But in fact, I wanted to ask you how long Cesar Chavez studied with you.
About 4 years.
Yeah. But I don't want to get off the track.
But back on the middle class, You see, for the last 10 years, 10 or 12 years, this country and many parts of Western Europe too, the so-called free world, has shifted over and becoming primarily middle class. About three quarters, if not more, of the population of this country are middle class, not just in terms, Ed, of the finances, having a financial industry of a floor income and an upper income, but primarily because they so identify themselves as such in terms of their style, their values, their goals, their objectives, what they want for their children, what they want for themselves. Ask them, and they say middle class. Ask George Meany about AFL-CIO, and he says, quotes, we are middle class, you know. Now, this is where the power is. This is what that Greek philosopher out of Washington has called the silent majority. A phrase which incidentally was first used by Homer, but when Homer used it, he was referring to the dead. Now, this middle class is not going to just stay there immobilized, and we see it today that they're not immobilized. They're going to move one way or the other. And I repeat again that this is where the power is, purely on a basis of numbers, outside of anything else. And take a look at any of the fights. When Cesar Chavez got into the battle on the Great Boycott was targeted to the middle class. After all, they were the ones who were asked not to buy the grapes. When we got into a fight with Kodak on the proxy thing you were talking about before, we were asking the middle class for stock proxies. You don't go into slums and ask people for stock proxies. They don't know what the hell you're talking about, you know.
Are the techniques different in organizing the middle class?
In certain ways, but not anywhere near as much as people think that they would be. There are certain universalities that apply to all people, whether you're organizing Eskimos, or I've been over to Asia this past few months and talking to Asiatic radicals and wanted to discuss tactics with me and so on. And Asiatics, Latin Americans, Canadian Indians that we're getting heavily involved with, it doesn't matter. There are certain basic things that people feel the same way about and react the same way to. There are certain differences on middle classes, with middle classes, but there are, just as there are differences with any other people. With middle class in our country here, there are a certain conditioning to avoid being controversial, to avoid being offensive, to avoid, offending anybody. You know, you see it on TV, and you have the kind of scene where, suppose you're at dinner in some suburban place, middle class, and somebody makes a statement that is so far out that the only thing that anybody who's had the advantage of coming out of the slums or, you know, out of the jungle, so to speak, where you know, it's a struggle for survival and you learn how to, you know, come out with it. Instead of saying and being honest and saying to the hostess, my God, from under what rock did you dig that out from under, you know, you never say that. You turn to the party and you say, well, now, there are two schools of thought on this subject, you know. You always avoid meshing with it or locking with it. Now, when you get into action is not polite. There's always a certain amount of crudity and a certain amount of vulgarity. And this is one of the problems when you're doing a middle-class organization. And this is why, all the way back to when you first started off, pollution's a nice, respectable issue, you know?
If the middle classes are the masses, which you've said, because they are by so far the majority, obviously the poor are in the minority.
That's right.
That being so, can the poor ever hope to have any real power?
Yes. Yeah, they are in the minority, as things stand. So much in a minority that if every black ghetto today was organized, I may be beating a dead cat here. I think we ought to make that point very clearly. If every black ghetto were organized in a black power, and every Mexican-American barrio was organized in a Mexican-American and Chicano power, and similarly with the Puerto Rican communities through the East, and similarly with the low-income Appalachian whites, and then through some genius of organization, you were able to effect a coalition of all these forces, you're absolutely right. They would be drastically insufficient in terms of numbers and power to make any significant changes. But what we can do is by organizing sectors of the middle class We will then begin on a basis of common need to set up alliances and coalitions there. That's where the change will come. And not, let me hammer as hard as I can, not through any altruism, not through any guilt feelings on the part of people. That stuff is chicken manure. It doesn't hold in the field of arena, in the field of power fights. It's when blacks and whites, for example, when they meet in a situation on a power basis where each needs the other for their own self-interest, then one, they are meeting as equals. Two, they're meeting with real dignity and we're getting together on it. And three, they're meeting as human beings and not as stereotypes where one looks at the other with a hostile image in his mind and vice versa. And four, they begin to knit on the basis of a human relationship. This is the reason why all armies from the beginning of time have always had a basic rule, no fraternizing with the enemy. Because the minute you begin fraternizing with the enemy, he stops being the enemy. You know, after a guy shows you pictures of his wife and babies and so on, you can't just sit back and shoot him down. It becomes murder. It's no longer battle.
Well, how do you work out common interests between, let's say, the poor and the middle classes? What interests do they have in common?
They need each other because the sectors that you will get in the middle class, I can see a situation of a lower middle class, blue-collar hard hat, they've got moving on certain things, and then they reach a point where they run out of track because they've got so many votes. And somebody comes up and says, well, what about that black organization over there? Now, you know, I feel about blacks just like you do. You know, they're going to stay away from this reform business because all you got to do is start saying, well, after all, we live in a kind of country, fellas, where all men are created equal, with the Judeo-Christian moral principle says so-and-so, and where our political traditions say so-and-so and so forth. And people just look at you. They don't argue with you. They don't engage with you. They just split and go their own way. They figure, oh, he's one of those guys, you know. Now, so you don't, this issue of joining up with a poor group doesn't come up during the early days of a blue-collar, hard-head, lower middle-income community. But if you come to, after a period of, say, a year and a half or so, and say, well, now look, we've gone about as far as our 80,000 votes are going to carry us. Now, over there, that black outfit, they got about 60,000 votes. Now, why can't we make a deal with them? It's got nothing to do with how we feel about each other. We'll support them for what they want, and they'll support us for what we want. Now, then comes the move together. Now, that's the basis on alliance or getting together in strength that's the only realistic thing. The other stuff, well, take a look at it. Look at the history of what happens to the other stuff.
Well, let's talk about the other stuff because you've often, certainly not too strong a word, you've often been scornful of the other stuff. That is to say, of work that other radical organizations do. Incidentally, how do you define radical, or do you?
Well, I never used the word radical. It was always used by the opposition. Mm-hmm. Every time in my life I've ever tried to do anything decent or anything that was meaningful, always the attack against me was, he's just a radical, you know. I remember, for example, in criminology.
When you were doing your research on the Al Capone gang.
That's right, which was actually the first American corporation that I worked within. I mean it. They were public in the truest sense. Everybody owned stock in the police department, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the works, you know. After all, here they were. They were providing the people of Chicago women, liquor, gambling, and other extracurricular activities. And that's a big occupation, you know, for the population of the city. We say that crime, here I am, a so-called criminologist, we say that crime comes out primarily out of unemployment, racial discrimination, slum housing, demoralization, deterioration, so forth. Then if that's the case, what are we horsing around with supervised recreation, something mysterious called character building programs? It's just plain crap, you know. We're staying away from the basic issues. Well, if you get into the basic issues, I've told, well, one, they're controversial. You get into the issue of low incomes, and the next thing you know, you're going to be taking sides with unions against management. You see, the whole thing in the professional world was this mystical, fictional, or fictitious objectivity. Of course we're all partisan. I've always said the only nonpartisan people were those who wore tombstones for hats. And the minute you say that, immediately they say, he's radical. He wants a change. I look up at a big corporation which is screwing the workers, and I say, let's shaft that corporation, let's change it. You're a radical right away. I'll tell you, the way I see it, I think the American Revolution is always going on. It never ends. I don't think any revolution ever ends. Because even after you win, the side that come, when we come in, let's put it this way, take back of the yards, the first big organization I built. Well, that's now part of the establishment. It's gone through the nightfall of success. There's no way of avoiding it, believe me. Education, anything else, I've tried all of that. But what you have to think of is in terms of when you go into revolt to change something, you do it with the hope that 20 years, 20 or 25 years from now, somebody else is going to come in and organize to revolt against the thing that you succeeded in doing and overthrow that. And 25 years later, somebody else is going to come in, and the process goes on endlessly. Now, the country has always been divided into radicals and Tories, and it still is today. We've got the radicals and Tories. As a matter of fact, I think today we can even use the battle slogans, no taxation without representation. Now, look at our United States Senate. Half of them are millionaires, and the other half are rapidly getting there. It costs a mint to try to run for office. They no longer really represent a lot of our people on it. And they've got a Senate bill that's supposed to compel disclosure of their personal assets. And it appropriately enough is titled SR 1993, which is probably the year it'll get reported out of committee, you know. And, well, you can see it even in our primaries. The big pitch now is the hitting on the tax scene and so on. So how do I define a radical? Webster's on a bridge says, radical, somebody gets down the roots of things. I say, I never paid much attention to it, but all I know is it has become a real clue that when you're hitting and when you're hurting, then the other side starts screaming and calling you a radical.